So today we want to continue talking about basics of singular systems, and last time we talked about some basic notation, definitions, and properties of signals. Today we want to begin talking about basic properties of systems, and we'll talk about a couple very important properties, causality and linearity, which we'll spend a lot of time in this class, and then we'll talk about a consequence of that, something known as time invariance. A system. So a system is a collection of one or more devices, processes, or computer-implemented algorithms that operates on a input signal X to produce an output signal Y. That's how we will view a system in this course this semester. When the inputs and outputs are continuous time signals, the system is said to be a continuous time system or an analog system, and we'll call such a system, and we'll use CT for shorthand notation for that. Now, you recall last time we talked about the concept of continuity with respect to the time dimension and the amplitude dimension. Here we're talking about the time dimension, applying the notion of continuity to the time dimension. So when inputs and outputs are discrete time signals, the system is said to be a discrete system, discrete time system, which we will call a DT system. So that's a major sort of split in this course. We'll spend about half the semester on each type of system, though a lot of the techniques we talk about will apply to both systems. It's just both types of systems. It's just some of the details will change.
What about systems that go from continuous to discrete or vice versa, data converters?
They're obviously both, right? We could argue philosophically, in reality, all systems are continuous time systems. Because, of course, you can't really, unless you're talking about being totally in the digital world, in terms of real physical systems, there is no notion of discreteness, really. But analog to digital converters, most of the time, we won't really discuss those much in this course. They're dealt with more extensively in the DSP course, and they're ultimately an analog system because they're composed of electronics. It takes a continuous time signal and somehow produces a binary signal or a binary representation of that signal. When you talk about devices like this, for example, you could think of it as a mixed analog and digital system because it's got the ability to process FM radio signals and such, and it inputs and outputs ultimately analog audio signals. But mainly we're talking about this in the context of how the signal is being, and how the signal is being represented, and not so much how the signal was collected or converted. Mathematical models of systems are very useful because they allow us to analyze, design, and predict the behavior of a system. We talked a little bit about this in the introduction. This is really more true now than it was 20 years ago, that many of you, even when you're doing what you think is analog circuit design, you're actually doing that design with respect to computer models. Now, when you lay a circuit out and you analyze it with SPICE, are the results that you get, are they real? No, they're just approximations. These tools have gotten so sophisticated that you can often meet people who don't understand the difference. I mean, they literally think, for example, that this is reality, what I'm getting in this computer simulation. So. Mathematical models are obviously they're essential today, but many of you will do most of your engineering work looking at you through the use of these models and not through the actual systems themselves. Now, where it gets interesting is when you build a system and the actual physical system doesn't work, which happens almost regularly. I don't know how much experience some of you have with building hardware yet, but I guarantee you, once you, if you actually go into building real hardware, it's not uncommon when you do these designs that you have to iterate on the designs. And a lot of the time, if you're working at, on the leading edge or state of the art with respect to hardware, particularly with respect to processor speed and things, a lot of those iterations are necessary because the computer models don't really capture the behavior of the circuit on the at the very edges of its speed or things. So every time I've been involved in building hardware, it's always fun to watch the hardware debugging, because once you get the first design and the simulation says everything works great, you build the system, it doesn't work. And then you begin, you know, first, if you then you begin basically patching the boards and then reiterating on the designs and such. When you're working with really, really high-speed circuits like computer processors and things, every little issue with how the traces are laid out and all that becomes a big issue. So you can get very close with the models, but the models are ultimately just approximations. So, you have a question?
I was just going to mention that when I come off with an example, that would be not getting the traces correct that were used for shielding. So even though the circuit worked in the simulation, they might have to spend hours troubleshooting it, and it'd just be something simple like the shielding was in the wrong place.
Yep. What company was that at?
PV Electronics.
PV?
Amplifiers.
Amplifiers, yep. That's a really good example of the kind of amplifiers PV builds. If some of you might have worked at Diversified Technologies where they build very high-speed computer boards. Another example of that, the actual board on which the processor sits is really a bunch of transmission lines, and you have a lot of little details you have to worry about. And the models generally don't predict these kinds of behaviors very well. They get you in the ballpark, but then you have to do a little bit of engineering work after that. So we're going to discuss two types of models in this class. We're going to talk about input-output representations. These are things like transfer functions that you use. When by now you've probably analyzed circuits and you've computed some simple transfer functions and things. That's a very common, very popular way to look at a circuit is a function which represents the ratio of the output to the input. But we're also going to talk a little bit about state or internal models, state-space models. These are used when you really want to get some understanding of what's going on inside of the system. And more advanced research and system development, these models are actually used to uncover structure in the underlying process when you want to learn something about the system. We use these kinds of models. Three types of input-output models are discussed in this course. The first one is the convolution model. This is a way of computing the output given an input and given a model of the system. And this is a way that operates in the time domain. A second approach are difference or differential equations. If you wondered why you've been through so many differential equation courses, well, now you're going to get to put that stuff to good use. Now, differential equations is a very important way that we model signal systems, and very often when you're trying to understand or develop a new model for a system, you get down into the physics and you use the physics to help you write differential equations, and then once you have those differential equations, the rest can be done by computer or done by some sophisticated analysis tools. But getting to the point where you have a characterization of the system as a differential equation, that's really the hard part, and that's actually what very often engineers will be involved in, especially when it's a new technology. Transfer functions are a third type of model, and we'll spend a lot of time on these, looking at Fourier transforms, Laplace transforms, and then for discrete time systems, the Z transform. But it's important to remember that the analysis tools that we will discuss in this course are used across a wide range of systems. So whether you're talking about electronic signals, or whether you're talking about the acoustics of this room or the acoustics of a concert hall, or whether you're talking about fluid flowing through pipes, all those use circuit analysis actually to analyze and model the systems. Once you work on getting the problem transformed to the circuit space, but once you get in the circuit space, we talk about acoustic impedances just like we talk about electrical impedances. And all the normal analysis that you've been exposed to is applied to those kinds of environments. So you'd be surprised as you get out in your engineering careers to see how important these operations are to many, many different disciplines. And that's another reason why I think this is a very important course, because it teaches you basic engineering principles that apply to many, many different types of problems. So let's first look at systems from an input-output perspective. Systems can be described by their input-output behavior. Now, that's a loaded statement. It's a very truthful statement, but it reminds me of the game 50 Questions or some such variant. It is true that systems can be described by their input-output behavior, but you need to make sure that when you're doing that, when you want to, for example, learn about a system by applying inputs and measuring outputs, you need to make sure that those inputs test all the different types of behaviors of the system. And that's something we'll talk about throughout the semester, but it's very important that when you're trying to characterize a system, that you make sure you test all of the different modalities of the system if you want to get a complete characterization of it. Of course, that's sort of a circular argument, because how do you know what those modalities are without understanding something about the system? And well, you're doing you're testing to understand something about the system. But you know, when you're given a black box and you're told, I mean, has anybody actually encountered this where someone's given you a black box and said, figure out what this thing does? It's a type of problem that would be very common on your first job, or especially if you do any kind of product work. And you know, the issue there is going to be, well, you need to make sure that however you test this box, that the inputs sweep its expected range of operation, so that you find out if it has any nonlinearities or any other problems or things like that. But how many times have you looked at a circuit and there's been some chip there for which you don't have a part number, or you know, one of these anonymous little chips, and it's got some symbol stamped on it that nobody's ever seen before, and you know, you try to figure out what's going on in that chip. Well, that's a problem in system analysis, and we're going to talk in this class about different ways you can characterize systems without understanding their internals. My area of research is interested in how you can actually learn about the internal structure of the system simply by measuring the inputs and outputs. And if you don't think that's important, well, think about all the effort that goes into understanding the behavior of the stock market by simply looking at the fluctuation of stock prices every day, or being able to predict weather by simply measuring weather on a daily basis. And we'll talk this semester about these kinds of applications. The form of the internal, so the input causes the output y, and the form of the internal system can vary and is often modeled by differential equations for continuous time systems and difference equations for discrete time systems. So on the right here we show two systems. For a continuous time system, we will show the input as x of t, the output is y of t. And in this course, we're going to spend time trying to develop mathematical models or computer models of the actual box, the CT system. We're going to ask questions like, what types of models should we use, and how can we actually compute the parameters of that model? The second system, in the discrete time case, it'll look very much the same way, except the input will be x of n, and the output will be y of n. And remember that the x of n is shorthand notation for x of n times capital T, where T is the sample period, and y of n is the corresponding thing for the output. So, on the lower left here, we have an example of a system in the form of a circuit. And a lot of what we will do in this course is to try to sort of bring all your circuit analysis that you've learned together and make you view that in a signals and systems sort of way, so that you can understand that circuits are no different than any other linear system in the way they behave. So here we have an input current and an output voltage, and we have a parallel RLC circuit, and we can now model it. One way to view this system would be as a black box where the input is a current and the output is a voltage. We could also view the input as a voltage and the output as a voltage. That's really how you view the inputs and outputs, are really up to you as a system designer. But in this case, we can write a differential equation for the relationship between the current and the voltage. We can write that the current is equal to the capacitance times the derivative of the voltage across the capacitance, plus the voltage divided by this resistance, plus the integral of the voltage across that inductor divided by the inductance. And we'll go through this kind of thing in more detail. You'll see this circuit many, many times throughout the semester as we introduce new modeling concepts. But from a system perspective, we have here a differential equation that has both derivatives and integrals associated with it. And we have a relationship between the voltage and the current expressed through that differential equation. And once we, and this is a very good model, because given any inputs, we can compute the corresponding output. Now, what's wrong with that model from an engineering point of view? You just spent a couple of years learning not to have to deal with that differential equation. Why? Because we like to torture you, right? Sort of technically, you learn this in physics, and the physicists will always tell you, oh, we know everything, we don't need all that other engineering stuff. But what's wrong with this from an engineering point of view?
It's not always accurate in the real world.
Okay, but the circuit analysis you learned isn't accurate in the real world either. Why did we spend so much time teaching you circuit analysis?
It's a lot easier.
Very good question.
It's a lot easier to just use phasers.
Exactly. Circuit analysis is a way of solving problems like this much easier using essentially algebra versus differential equations. So, what's wrong with this? Well, for a circuit that has many components, you have a high order differential equation. Those are not terribly easy to solve. Even this system is not terribly easy to solve. And I'm sure you would much rather use algebra, and you've done that, than use, and you know, impedances and things like that. Some of you may have been exposed already to Laplace transforms of the circuit, than actually try to solve and manipulate that differential equation. So engineering is all about taking the basic math and shaping it into something that allows us to easily design, analyze, and optimize circuits. So if I gave you this differential equation, if you had, for every different input that you might apply, if you had to solve this differential equation repeatedly, that's just very time consuming. And you can't get any real insight into how to change the values of these components that way. Now, fortunately, in today's world, it really doesn't matter, because most of the time today, you can just throw this into a schematic capture, and then you don't really care what the computer is using to solve the circuit, but you can, from the schematic capture, go directly to transfer functions and things. You've learned that with SPICE. We'll show you how to do that with MATLAB this semester. And therefore, the good news is all that circuit analysis you've done by the end of this semester will all just be to you a computer tool. And you can manipulate circuits in MATLAB. You can provide various inputs, measure outputs. You can adjust frequency responses and all these kinds of things. And you can do all that without much understanding of the underlying differential equations. But when you get to the real world and you apply a 1,000 volts to that circuit and you watch a few of the components melt, then you realize, okay, my model isn't quite right, or I've got some issues. And in fact, one of the things we'll study extensively this semester is the notion of linearity. Resistors, inductors, capacitors behave linearly for a certain range of their operation, but then they become nonlinear devices at some point. And in the extreme, they melt or they blow up, and it's not much of anything. And we can model circuits both as linear and nonlinear systems. And we'll learn a little bit about that, about the nonlinear aspects of that this semester. So there's an example of an RLC circuit. You've learned how to compute voltages, currents, transient responses, steady state responses, and transfer functions. But what you didn't know is that that same analysis could be used for a mechanical system. This could just as easily be a system of springs and masses. It could be a system of fluid flowing through pipes. Or it could be a concert hall. And you could be adjusting baffles in the concert hall to make the music sound really good. Or it could be a surround sound system. We'll talk a little bit this semester about things like surround sound and all that, which are really good examples of these kinds of systems. In this course, we'll generalize these tools to deal with any type of linear system. So here's some more examples of physical systems. Physical systems can also be modeled. In fact, all systems really, at some point, all useful systems are physical systems. So the circuit analysis that you use came about from a detailed understanding of the physics of the various components. Physical systems can be modeled by differential equations so that their input-output behavior can be studied using the same techniques that we use with electric circuits. So here we have on the right a mass and a spring, and we can write equations that represent the force in terms of forces related to the mass, forces related to the spring, and forces related to friction. And when you look at that equation, you say, well, that looks a lot like the RLC circuit that I just showed. In fact, the two systems share the same differential equation. And therefore, once you get the problem mapped into this state, the results are going to be the same for either system. You don't really care which one it is. All you really care about is what is the input, in this case, force being applied to that mass, and what is the output, in this case, the displacement of the spring. And where it gets really interesting is when you try to build the or simulate the properties of an analog system digitally. And this is, of course, one of the things that's happening in many, many disciplines as more and more things become electronic. So, for example, in the automobile, if you look at the evolution of the automobile over the last 50 years, you see increasingly more things done, quote-unquote, analog or with physical systems are now being done electronically. The amount of electronics in a car continues to increase, and now with electric vehicles and things, we're kind of seeing the end state of that, that cars will be almost entirely electronics. And why these equations become important? Well, if you want that car to drive like your customer wants it to feel, the customer doesn't really want to know that you're now you have essentially a digitally controlled suspension. They just want to know that it drives and feels like that Ferrari or Porsche or whatever it is they're thinking. In fact, with these models, in the early days of digital signal processing, we had all sorts of dreams. One of them was, oh, gee, we could take a AMC Gremlin or whatever here, whatever cheap cars are these days, and make it feel like a Porsche just by putting, you know, enough electronics on it that we can control the way it drives and feels. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. But it was, you know, a nice, one of the early demonstrations that did catch people's attention very early on in the field of digital signal processing. They took a recording of Enrico Caruso, famous opera singer many years ago, and they only had him recorded in these really old-style gramophone recordings. They separated his voice from the recording environment and remixed it with modern equipment, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, Caruso's alive again. Well, that was done about 30 years ago, about 40 years ago. And that's really one of the key demonstrations that got people excited in digital signal processing. Well, today, of course, that's become a very common technology. That's done all the time in the audio industry. Well, we can do that because what they did is they were able to develop a good differential equation model of the recording conditions at the time his voice was recorded, and then they were able to then separate his voice from the environment in which he was recorded and remix his voice with new instrumentation and such. More complex systems are often modeled as a cascading of components. So here we have a picture of the speech production system, which begins with air in your lungs and eventually what exits your mouth and lips is a sound pressure wave. And we actually model this as a series of linear systems. We have a linear model of this process. And that allows us then to go from digital information to actually generate speech. So when you listen to some of these computer automated attendants that have that kind of mechanical voice associated with them, they are in fact starting from somebody decides what words and phrases they want the system to speak, and that information is pushed through a series of these differential equation models, and what comes out the other end is real speech, and it sounds almost like a human. And that's done because we have very good differential equation models of how this system works. And the physicists and engineers have worked over the years to come up with those models. And then once we have those models, engineers step in and are able to convert those models into algorithms and software and things like that. And this is an interesting example to me. Actually, what got me interested in this area, because it was very interesting to me that we ultimately model this analog system as a circuit. And it's kind of neat. And discrete time models like this are an integral part of modern computer and information technology. So when you're doing circuit analysis with SPICE or just about any system can be modeled and simulated in MATLAB today. Later in the semester, we'll talk about things like the end-to-end simulations of automobiles and things. Some industries have developed enormously complex models in MATLAB that allow you to actually design a car, for example, and drive that car through a normal course, like roads and things, and predict gas mileage and all those things. All that can be done now with computer simulations. Weathering, one of the most computationally intensive tasks is modeling of the weather, and weather prediction over the years has gotten really, really good because they're able to apply many, many models and using lots and lots of data that's been collected over many, many years. Yeah, they actually got yesterday's forecast wrong, which is interesting. It was supposed to be sunny yesterday. So, some observations about all this. Well, a very rich class of systems, but by no means all systems of interest to us, are described by differential and difference equations. As powerful as differential equations are, there are systems that do not lend themselves to description by differential equation. And that's particularly true in the internet world. If you're trying to model the browsing behavior of a human, or you're trying to model... I read a book this past week about modeling the world, if you will, by the search terms that people enter into Google. It turns out you can tell quite a lot about what's going on in the world by looking at the frequency of search terms. And this author, who's very famous for this, actually predicted the outcomes of some of the American Idol competitions, the elections, and all of that, just by looking at the frequency of search terms being entered into Google. Now, those kinds of models are not strictly differential equation models. But for this class, we'll focus mostly on systems that are linear and can be modeled by differential equations. But that's not the end of the story. It's really just the beginning of the story. Such an equation by itself does not completely describe the input-output behavior of a system. We need auxiliary conditions, initial conditions, and boundary conditions. And these turn out to be really critical. If you want a very detailed model of my voice, a human voice, you need not to know just how I move my lips and tongues and things like that, but you also need to know something about the viscosity of my mouth. Is my mouth dry today? Is my mouth wet today? Those are what we call boundary conditions. Initial conditions with circuits. You've seen this when you look at an RLC circuit. Does the capacitor have an initial charge to it? If it does, the behavior of the circuit is going to be different as opposed to if that capacitor is discharged. So initial conditions form a very important part of how we specify the overall system. In fact, some systems, nonlinear systems in particular, their behavior changes based on the initial conditions. And that's a very interesting phenomenon that we'll talk about later in the semester. In some cases, the system of interest has time as the natural independent variable, and it is what we call causal. And today, we'll formally define the notion of causality. However, that's not always the case. Space plays an integral role in image processing, and we talked about motion pictures last time that have both space, the pixel locations, and time, the frames associated with them. Some data is simply represented as index lists, sequences of words on a page. If you're writing software to model the frequency of words that appear on the internet, It's those are signals. You could think of those as signals, but they don't necessarily relate to time or space. It's just an index list of information. In MATLAB, everything ultimately is going to be a vector, what that vector actually represents will be up to you, but mathematically, we'll deal with everything just as a vector or a matrix. Very different physical systems may have very similar mathematical descriptions, and the beauty of such mathematical abstractions is that you can solve the system once and apply it to many disciplines. For example, the circuit analysis paradigm is used to model fluid flow in acoustic environments like we talked about. So, what I'd like to point out about that statement is that as undergrads, you think you're here to learn how to solve a first and second differential equation, right? We teach you that, and once you know that, you can go out and get paid money to do that, right? Unfortunately, this is the part that depresses you, but then I'll make you feel better later, so, but you get depressed right now. Unfortunately, most of what you learn as undergraduate engineers is already well known and already computerized, and they don't need to hire you to actually do that work. They have computers that do that work for you. So you spend all this time learning circuit analysis, but you don't actually use that directly, you could say, because computers are able to do all the analysis and such. And most of what you learn as an undergraduate is knowledge that we already have quantified into computer programs and computer models and things. So that's the depressing part, that you can't really get a job doing circuit analysis. When I first learned calculus, I thought, boy, if I could just get a job doing integrals and differentiation all day, I'd love it. Because, you know, I really love working all those problems and things like that. But, you know, by the time I got in, you know, far enough along, I realized that even then we already had computers and things that did all this, so I couldn't, you know, get a job doing that. Well, that was too much, too good. But the knowledge that you gain in understanding those models is what's important. While many systems can be approximated as linear circuits, in practice, most systems are nonlinear and can experience complex behaviors such as chaos. And so one of the things you need to take away from this class is that one of the basic skills you have as an engineer is to take a complex system. We were talking about traffic flow the other day. Has anyone got caught up in some of the traffic jams that have been either on campus at the beginning of the semester, every semester we go through this, or they're doing some power construction along a couple of the roads adjacent to campus, and they create these massive traffic jams because they don't know how to manage traffic. Well, you know, what you as an engineer will often do is you'll go into problems like that and you'll develop linear solutions as a first order approximation. And then you'll run some models and see how well that describes the system. And then you'll start to branch out from there and make the models more and more sophisticated to handle more and more of the sort of finer tuned behavior of the system. But most systems, even if you're talking about simple things like traffic flow is a really interesting problem because it's something that we face everywhere in the US. And yet, there are very few good computer models that can really predict and understand traffic flow because it's a very complicated process. And it ultimately involves a lot of human behavior trying to predict. People basically do just about everything wrong when it comes to driving, and that's what makes traffic flow. So, for example, if you know, in many of the major metropolitan cities, they have systems now that can adapt to traffic jams and things and try to reroute traffic, but of course humans always are trying to beat the system, so it becomes almost a problem in game theory, because by the time, you know, they'll broadcast alternate route on the radio, but by the time that's usually broadcasted, people have already tried to game that route's usually become full and they're working on another route. So there's all sorts of complex behaviors. If you watch the way people drive, if everyone would just stay in the lane and keep a fixed distance and move at a constant speed, everything would be great, but that's not how people work. They've got a lane change, they've got to pass, they got to do, and that's what creates all the problems. Those kinds of systems are obviously very nonlinear, but you can get some first order approximations like, you know, I should build a four-lane highway here or this and that using linear approximations. And so one of your skills as an engineer is actually to go into problems and linearize them. And then based on that linearization, suggest solutions. So system properties. So we're going to begin now talking about some important system properties. Why bother analyzing systems in terms of basic properties of behavior such as linearity, causality, and time invariance? Well, this has important practical and physical implications. We can make many important predictions of the system behaviors without having to do any mathematical derivations. They allow us to develop powerful tools such as Transform for design and analysis. And for example, once you determine a system is linear, many important mathematical properties hold. In fact, it turns out all linear systems can be modeled using a common framework, which we'll discuss in this course. So just the very fact of making the system linear pretty much means that its behavior then is very well understood. And we'll talk, you will hopefully appreciate that by the end of the semester. Principles such as causality are actually applied across many disciplines. I haven't said what causality is yet, but causality is a very important property of most physical systems. And in a discrete time domain, we can often implement systems that go beyond the limits of the real world because programming languages allow you to implement very complex algorithms. So if you look at some of these simulation games now that are sort of trying to simulate the real world and allow people to do multiple role playing and all that, these systems actually have gotten very, very complicated models. And these models often can go far beyond what we can do in the real world because they're not limited by principles of physics or principles like conservation of energy or things like that. Despite many years of progress, many very simple physical systems are still beyond our modeling capabilities. I am fascinated by the way water flows out of a faucet. If you ever watch the way water comes out of your kitchen faucet, I just am fascinated by this because if you watch it, it will often change states in a very subtle way. Even something simple like that, the water flowing through that curved tube and coming out in that kind of chaotic way where it shifts between different states, that's not something we have a very good mathematical model for. And yet that's a very, very simple physical system. But we can come close with some of the models that we'll discuss this semester. So now we're going to go through some specific properties. A system is causal if the output does not depend on future values of the input. If the output at any time depends only on values of the input up to that time. Okay, so this is a very fundamental concept when we talk about physical systems. All real-time physical systems are causal because time only moves forward. Effect occurs after cause. So what does that mean? Well, when you talk about a physical system, for example, if I talk about this table and I apply some kind of impulse to that table, this system cannot depend on future values of its output. That's just not possible. If we could do that, if you could understand behavior in the future at time now, you know, think of the implications that would have on, for example, being able to predict the price of stock. And you can, you know, and of course, science fiction has played with this notion, time travel and such. But it's a really fundamental concept, and it really does sort of control how the world operates. Causality does not apply to spatially varying signals. For example, in images, we can move both left and right, up and down, without impacting the causal nature, but the time dimension of that video signal, we can talk about causality. Causality does not apply to systems processing recorded signals, tape sports events and such, versus live broadcasts. In a live broadcast of a sporting event, they can't tell you what the final score is going to be, but in a taped broadcast, have you ever listened to narration that's been done on a taped broadcast versus a live broadcast? Sometimes you'll catch this when you watch some of the sports channels or something that do like replays of games, only the narration will not. Well, the narrators sound a lot smarter, right? Because they know everything that's happened and they can explain. And you can actually do a much better job of narrating if you've seen the game once. And so that's an example of causal versus non-causal. So examples of causal systems. Well, we have y of t is equal to x of t. Y of t is equal to x of t minus 1. Y of t is equal to x of t plus 1. Okay, so let's think about it. So here, clearly y of t is dependent only on x of t. So we would call that system causal. Here, y of t is dependent on x of t minus 1. Now, X of t minus 1, is that in the future or is that in the past? See, so now we're going to start using the time shifting property you talked about. That's the future. Well, what about x of t plus 1? So, if you have... Anybody want a question? So here we have x of t. If y of t is equal to x of t minus 1, when does y of t occur?
3 to 4.
Okay. Everybody agree with that?
Because you're being right here.
So, if this is x of t, and y of t is equal to x of t minus 1, when does y of t occur? 3 to 4, right? I think if you think about, if you follow the principle I said, don't think about the theory, just plug in a few values, right? When t is 3, t minus 1 is 2. Okay. So, does y of t depend on future or on the past?
Past.
So this is backwards in time. See, I told you last class you'd get this backwards, but... and this is future in time. So is this system causal?
No.
No, this is not causal. If you could do this, you could make lots of money on the stock market. Because this means you could predict the price today of a stock tomorrow. Now this system we'll see is nonlinear, but it is causal because t is still dependent on t. This system is also nonlinear, but causal because there still is just a dependence on t. And we have the equivalent concepts in the discrete time sense here. And we have some more examples here of relationships expressed through integrals. And I want you to think about these. You'll actually talk about these in the problem-solving class, which first class will be tomorrow night. In this discrete time system, it's very easy to see that this is non-causal because there's a dependence on the future. But with these integral relationships, maybe it's not so easy to see. So think about that, and you'll talk about those in more detail when you look at homework problems. Now, linearity is another very important concept. A system is linear if it obeys the principle of superposition. This means if x1 produces y1 and x2 produces y2, then a times x1 plus b times x2 produces a times y1 plus b times y2. Now that's a mathematical way of stating what some people sometimes call the principle of linearity and superposition. But what that simply means is that if the input, if for a system that behaves those properties, if you increase the amplitude of the input, the output will increase by the same amount. So, if we have a system whose input-output relationships look like this, well, obviously it's linear because as I make changes in x, I will see those corresponding changes in y. So, if I double the value of x, I will get double the value of y as output. Now, in contrast, here's a system which is nonlinear, because clearly at some point, as I double the value of the input, I do not get double the value of the output. And that's why you've learned that devices like transistors and diodes and such are nonlinear elements. In the real world, we're talking about the difference between real world and simulation. In the real world, even resistors will behave this way. Why? Because they'll burn at some voltage. Here we have a system which may or may not be linear. I'll ask you to think about that example, and again, you'll discuss that when you get to the homework problems. Here we have a system which where the output is equal to the input times a cosine function. And you might think about, does this system obey that property? And you can actually derive, you can go through the simple derivation of that. You'll do something like that in the homework. Here's another one of my favorite examples of a nonlinear system. Why is a battery nonlinear? Well, eventually it's going to run out of power. And in fact, from the very moment you start drawing power from a battery, it becomes nonlinear. Though it can be approximated over a certain life part of its lifetime as a linear system. And another example I like to use is the volume control on your radio. Is the volume control, is the volume of your radio a linear system? So if I, you'll have to suffer through my jokes about This Is Spinal Tap, but there's a movie, This Is Spinal Tap, that has a very famous scene about this. And I'll send you the link to it because you have to be aware of this as an engineer. But when you turn this thing from one, and if you haven't had Spinal Tap, you really should go and watch it because it is all about engineering. It's actually about requirements engineering and this issues like linearity. Well, it is. Well, there's the whole thing where they write the requirements of the big obelisks. Yeah. And they put the actual dimensions. So instead of being this big, it's this big.
It was a unit conversion problem.
Right. So when you turn that knob from 1 to 2, does the amplitude of the electrical signal that's coming out of your radio increase by a factor of 2? No. But what does happen is you perceive it as being, in some sense, you perceive it as being twice as loud. Actually, you don't even perceive it as being twice as loud. But the volume, the numbers on your volume dial, are those arranged on a linear scale? No, those are actually arranged logarithmically. Right. Why?
Because your ears are listening to this.
Because your perception of the loudness of music or audio is more logarithmic than it is linear. So that's an example of a nonlinear system. And it was designed to be purposely to be nonlinear. Now, time invariance is one I really like talking about because it's a great, great problem and it has really big implications in the real world. So informally, a system is time invariant if its behavior does not depend on the choice of time. Then two identical experiments will yield the same results regardless of the starting time. So what this means mathematically, we'll start with discrete time. This means that for any input x of n and any time shift n0, if you apply x of n and you get an output y of n, and then you apply x of n minus n0, where n0 is just some constant, then what you should get out is y of n minus n0. Similarly, for a time continuous time system, if you apply x of t, you get an output y of t. And if you apply x of t minus t0, you get an output y of t minus t0. Now, that's a mathematical way of stating what is really a very simple concept, which is, if I hit the table now, and you hear a sound, and you'll hear that on the recording, and I hit the table the same way a minute from now, you would expect to hear the same sound. That's all time invariance is. It's important because it means that circuit you built will behave the same way whether you apply that input today, tomorrow, or the next day. And here's some examples of systems which are time invariant. Some aren't. And again, you'll go through those in more detail. But clearly, systems like this are time invariant. Now, give me an example of a system that's not time invariant.
Weather.
No, it depends on the previous day.
Hmm. Weather's.
Can you say that? Is a system?
Give me a simpler example.
Anything that behaves.
Traffic's a good example because you try to start out from home the same time, the same day, and things don't always work out that way. The stock market's another example I like to give. It's sort of a very basic example that if you invest a dollar today, you'll get some return, let's say, negative or positive, a year from now. If you invest that dollar tomorrow, will you get the same return? And the answer is no, because the system fluctuates differently. It's a very dynamic system.
What about speech?
We actually model speech as a linear time invariant system, but in reality, the way you speak a word changes. And as you age and things like that, the properties of your voice also change. So any system that ages is actually not is time variant. But for a lot of the mathematical properties of time invariant systems are pretty simple, so we'll use that as a very important model. Now, one consequence of this, which we'll come to, we'll reinforce later in the semester, is that if a system, if the input to a time invariant system is periodic, then the output is also periodic with the same period. And we'll talk about this at great extent when we get into our transforms and things, but it's a very important basic consequence that if a system is a linear time invariant system, when you apply a periodic signal, like a sine wave, you will get out a periodic signal, that same sine wave. Now, most systems in reality are not linear time invariant. For example, your amplifiers at home for your audio systems produce all sorts of non-linear terms, and we'll talk about that a little later in the semester. But because we can build complex systems out of simple signals, we can use the principle of linearity to compute the output of complex signals by summing the outputs from the simpler signals. So we'll constantly be using this fact to build up our ability to model systems using a set of very simple operators and simple signals. Okay, so I think that's where we'll stop there today. There's an example for discrete time systems at the end of this lecture that you can look at and discuss in the recitation section.
I guess it works.